NWA. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw a mind of your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning and Happy New Year. We're here today to hear the matter of Jackson and Kelly versus the Secretary. Are counsel ready to proceed? Okay, would counsel for the appellants state their name for the record?
I'm sorry, I'm appearing on behalf of both Ms. Jackson and Mr. Kelly. Carpenter also appearing as well.
And for the government?
Edward Cassidy Jr. and Mr. Ken Walsh.
Okay, we generally have 30 minutes per side. I think I'll stay with that, and we'll just simply be as flexible as we need to be in terms of any additional times that you think you might need to present, Mr. Carpenter. So we'll, right now, I'll set 20 and 10 for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You may proceed. And let me ask, let's start with Kelly.
Okay. You want me to start presenting on Kelly first as opposed to you have a question on Kelly first?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you can start. We'll probably ask our questions at the appropriate time.
If I could begin with a preliminary statement before I speak to Kelly. As a preliminary matter, I'd like to clarify my position in the filing of these motions. As attorney in these cases, I filed these motions jointly with the appellants. So these motions are filed by both the appellant and myself as attorney. As I read 7263C, the option is given to either party. It does not indicate that they can file them jointly specifically, but that is or was my intent in these
and
cases.
And you are referring to 7263?
7263C. And that is the authority under which I believe that this court has authority to review the fee agreements in both of these cases.
So since you raised that, in terms of filing a motion or the court sua sponte reviewing a fee agreement, what is the basis upon which the court would either sua sponte or entertain a motion at this time on Kelly? Is there a matter pending before the court involving Kelly?
There was not a matter pending before the court, Your Honor, and 7263C does not address that issue specifically. This court in the Fritz decision dealt with that question tangentially and observed that the court felt that it had authority under 7263 to review sua sponte, but that matter was different because there was a pending matter, an EJA application in Fritz that was pending. Clearly, there is no EJA application pending, and that is, I suppose, a threshold question for this court to deal with. It is not addressed in this court's rules, and there is no indication as to when, and the same is true, Your Honor, for 5904C until recently. The VA has promulgated regulations that set specific time limits under which requests for review of fee agreements must be made either by the Secretary or by the parties.
Why isn't it addressed in the Federal Circuit's opinion in WIC?
Why isn't it addressed in the Federal Circuit?
Why didn't they say that we only have jurisdiction when we have a matter otherwise before us? Paraphrasing.
Well, I suppose WIC could be read that way, Your Honor. I did not understand WIC to make that holding, but
if you look at WIC, I'm looking at language in WIC, it says, thus, let's see, it would be on page, let me find the page number.
371.
I'm sorry?
371.
371, it says, discussing, there's a paragraph discussing this very issue, and it says, thus, fee agreements are properly before the court only when it reviews decisions of the board concerning an agreement or on any other matter decided by the board. It even talks about the fact that the court, continuing on, that we recognize that the court at one time properly had jurisdiction over that particular claim for veterans' benefits. However, the court's judicial power over the case terminated after the court remanded it to the board, and the case has now been fully adjudicated and cannot be affected by the present motion.
Well, I was reading that in relationship to 5904 and the direct appeal, and did not read it as this court is reading it. And on reflection, I think that that is a reasonable interpretation of WIC, that this court does not have sua sponte jurisdiction under 7263 to take
up.
That's
what WIC wasn't sua sponte. They asked the court to review it.
I'm sorry. That does not have independent jurisdiction. I should not have said sua sponte. That it does not have independent jurisdiction. And to that extent, I suppose WIC would control the motion that is pending before the court in Kelly.
In Kelly. So in Kelly, would you concede then that we have no jurisdiction in Kelly and we should really devote our time here to Jackson?
I think that's probably true, Your Honor.
But now, just for edification, I suppose you were mentioning something about the VA regulations, and of course in Kelly, your factual predicate is that you have a decision below.
That's correct.
In favor of Mr. Kelly.
Yes.
And there's just some further contention over the effective date, and that would give the RO or the board perhaps some jurisdiction under 5904 or their own regulations to
Yes, unfortunately, the regulation does not indicate that the regulation is applicable retroactively. And the problem is that when that event occurred in Kelly, the circumstances were review by the board. Review is no longer available directly by the board under 5904. Review is now only available through the agency in the first instance because of the amendment to 5904.
Okay. So in Jackson, we're all pretty familiar with the facts in Jackson. What is the link, if you will, in Jackson that gives us jurisdiction?
The fact that this court had just decided the EJIA petition and that the matter of the EJIA petition was still before the court and had not become final at the time in which this motion for review.
And as I recall, I guess we had approved the original EJIA application, then that triggered your eligibility to file for supplemental EJIA.
For fees on fees, that's
and
correct.
And to do that, you had to ask that mandate be recalled.
That's correct.
And so then we approved the supplemental
fee petition, which then triggered the two questions that are being presented in the Jackson motion.
Okay.
And if I could begin by a comparison with what I think this court decided in the Carpenter v. Principi case in Bonk and how that case differs from the case that is presented here in Jackson. In Carpenter, excuse me, the matter was being reviewed under 5904C. In other words, it was a direct appeal of a decision by the board, an appeal taken by the attorney for review by this court under its review jurisdiction for decisions made under 5904. The board in that case had reduced the fee from 30% and concluded that the attorney was legally bound to refund to Mr. Weatherspoon, who was the veteran in that case, the fees awarded under the Equal Access to Justice Act fee. The underlying case in that matter was a claim of clear and unmistakable error in a 1981 VA decision, which had been denied and then appealed to the board. In February of 1998, the parties entered into a joint remand, and that joint remand was granted. That resulted in an award of EJIA fees of $2,473.17. In August of 1998, the board found that there had in fact been a clear and unmistakable error in the 1981 rating decision and remanded the matter for revision to the VA. In September of 1998, the VA assigned an effective date of 1991 through 1993, which was the existing award for a total rating for Mr. Weatherspoon, and awarded past due benefits in the amount of $200,000, which resulted in an attorney fee under the fee agreement of 30% of $61,000, and then the question became the matter of the offset, as was decided by the board. In the Jackson case, there is no predicate board decision. This matter has not been reviewed by the board and is not on appeal to this court by the board, or excuse me, from a decision by the board, but is before this court on the joint motion of the appellant and the appellant's attorney under 7263C. Therefore, Jackson is asking this court to review the fee agreement in the first instance. Also, the difference or distinguishing factors between the Carpenter case and the Jackson case is the nature of the fee agreement in Carpenter. The fee agreement in Carpenter included and was the dispositive factor in that decision for representation throughout the proceedings before both this court and before the agency, and obligated the attorney to undertake continuing representation on remand. That is not the case in Jackson. In Jackson, the fee agreement was exclusively for representation before this court. The fee agreement did call for...
Aren't you actually asking us for an advisory opinion here? As I understand the situation, you have not taken an adversarial position that you're entitled to these fees. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. And your client apparently has not taken an adversarial position that you are not entitled to these fees, but rather both of you have come up here, instead of negotiating between each other, both of you have come up here and said to the court, please interpret this and let us know what is proper, reasonable, and appropriate.
That is
so consequently, why would we step into this instead of letting you take an adversarial position against your client, or vice versa, or perhaps settle it?
Well, number one, Your Honor, I don't believe that that's the intent of Congress in 7263. 7263 is a unique statute, at least in my experience, in which the court is given authority upon a motion by a party or by an attorney to review a fee agreement.
For what? For its reasonableness?
For its excessiveness or its reasonableness.
Yeah, now, and if we get down, let's go, if you want to go down that road, then I got several questions that we need to ask. Satisfied with your
Did I answer your question?
Well, no.
I'm sorry.
You partially answered it, but I am asking just in general. Yes, we have authority to review it. Presumably, though, wouldn't there have to be a disagreement?
And I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the very broadness, the breadth of 7263 suggests that the only thing that is required is that any of the parties identified.
So we could
in the
take your motion and kind of absorb it and then sua sponte. Clearly we could sua sponte review this, and clearly we could sit here and say, we don't care if you guys agree or not, but we're not going to let you take 30%. Well, we are going to let you take 30%. So I guess we could take your motion under that, guys. And okay.
Yeah. Well, and as I read this court's decision in Fritz, that's the way that I understand this court interpreted 7263, that this court does have that sua sponte authority.
Well, I think I'm not disputing that. I was
okay. I'm sorry.
How it's presented. We have not yet exercised this.
Oh, no,
sua sponte.
No, you have not.
And so the two parties are kind of coming to us begging and saying, we don't want to get together, we don't want to argue this. And I guess it still comes back to the question of, why would we do that? Why don't you guys first decide whether you... Because obviously this court didn't step in sua sponte. It didn't look at this and raise an issue.
But now you're tempting me to say, should we have, based on something you just said, and that was your fee agreement did not cover your representation before the Federal Circuit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you have no contract with Mrs. Jackson concerning fees for that representation.
No, Your Honor, but this court had already granted the EJIA application and awarded the hours under this court's decision in Hensley,
right,
finding that those hours were part of the case that was presented to this court.
Which hours?
The hours before the Federal Circuit. This court approved those hours. Those hours have already been approved.
Right. Right, and I guess without a sua sponte review of the fee agreement.
Well, that's right. And if this court had chosen to, then I think this court could have asked that question, certainly. But
let's put salt on an old wound.
Okay. Uh-oh.
I guess we're all in agreement that a pro bono attorney can receive EJIA fees.
Mm-hmm.
Some mysteriously way, I mean, that there's...
Why do you say we're all in agreement, Chief?
This court's current state of the law says that.
Doesn't mean we agree with it.
That's true. That's why it's a wound.
Yes.
Let's take it another step and say you have a contingency fee contract. And in this case, Mrs. Jackson agreed to pay you 30% of any past due awards, and that was going to be her obligation to you. For attorney fees.
That's right. If there was an award based upon the representation of court.
But you also got an opportunity to file an EJIA application based on hourly rate.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that that's an important...
Well, let me just close the loop here. So question. Why are you not limited, pursuant to the terms of your agreement, to only the 30%? And if EJIA is higher, you don't get it. The client gets it. Because the EJIA awards are the client's. And your agreement specifically said that you were limited to the 30%. We'll take out that little EJIA portion that you have in there for now.
Because, Your Honor, there was no award of past due benefits as a result of the representation before court. And my fee agreement, the fee agreement that is the subject matter of review here, does not include or otherwise require me to represent before the agency. So the limited fee agreement that is before this court only contemplates an award of a 30% contingent fee in the event that representation before this court results in an award of past due benefits. That did not happen.
I don't think it says that. You want to show me where it says that? You're only entitled to a fee if ultimately you're awarded down below, correct?
No, I'm only entitled to the 30% fee under this fee agreement if the representation before this court results in an award of past due benefits.
Well, let's go look at the agreement. Let's start on page one, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Good starting place.
paragraph 2C. Says the services contemplated by this fee agreement for representation before the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims shall encompass all claims previously decided by the department, et cetera, et cetera. Going to page 2, the scope of the representation. The client's representation before the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and, if required, for continuing representation before the Department of Veterans Affairs to include the Board of Veterans Appeals is this within the scope. Looking at paragraph 4, the attorney shall provide all services reasonably necessary and required to prosecute the appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and, if required, to continue representation of the client before the Department of Veterans Affairs to include the Board of Veterans Appeals. Subparagraph B, the primary objective of the attorney shall be to secure for the client, whether the veteran and or the veteran's spouse or dependents, an opportunity for re-adjudication of the entitlement of benefits to which they may be entitled, or the outright reversal. Attorneys, subparagraph C, attorney's first efforts will be to secure the order from the court or a court remand. Subparagraph E, the parties agree that the work performed before the court and work performed on remand to the Board of the Veterans Appeals or thereafter in the regional office to re-adjudicate the veteran's claim is not the same work. Subparagraph F. This representation agreement contemplates that the attorney will pursue the matter on behalf of the client following the court remand order and vacating the prior BVA decision of the Board and Board of Veterans Appeals, which has vacated, which was vacated by the court action, and upon which re-adjudication has been ordered by the court, by the Board of Veterans Appeals and or the regional office, if necessary, in order to secure for the client the award of past due benefits. The continued representation of the client by the attorney before the Department of Veterans Affairs to include the Board of Veterans Appeals flows from and is the result of the successful representation of the client before the court. It seems to me that flowing through this, and I could go on and read some other paragraphs, but it seems to me that the clear intent of these paragraphs would seem to say that that this the scope of the representation here is not limited solely to the court, because the fee is contingent upon, number one, the fee is contingent on the receipt of benefits, and number two, you have paragraphs interspersed throughout here, although some admittedly contradictory, that continue to reference continued representation at the agency. So it's hard for me to reconcile those types of that type of language in the contract with the statement that you made that the contract does not contemplate anything but representation here.
Well,
can you resolve that for
me? In terms of the payment of a contingent fee for the representation before the court was what I was trying to articulate. This contract does provide that the client has an option after successful representation to enter into a fee agreement with another attorney, that they're not under a continuing obligation to be represented by me. Clearly,
well,
what
actually,
is contemplated...
Well, actually, if they sever the relationship and then subsequently obtain benefits, they're still bound under this contract to pay you the contingency.
I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor. That would not be the position that
I'm sure you wouldn't want to do that, except for maybe quantum merit work that you've done. But it seems
well,
that
except
that
I would have been paid for the quantum merit work that I'd done vis-a-vis Egypt. The fact is that
not if the client withdrew before you were successful at the court.
Oh, I see, Your Honor. But obviously that's not the fact set here.
No, I understand.
But what I was trying to get at was that the perception on my part following the decision in Carpenter was that the problem that the court had was that the representation agreement clearly obligated continuing obligation on the part of both parties for representation back before the agency, and that if it was going to do that, then there was going to be an obligation to offset because that was part of the work that was negotiated for under the contract. The clear intent of drafting this contract for representation before the court and identifying it before the court was to clearly delineate that there was a separate representation before the court, and then there would be a separate representation, and as in fact...
Where did you do that? Are you suggesting that on page 3, subparagraph E, where you put in bold, is not the same work? That little phrase there gave that understanding to anybody reading this?
No, Your Honor. There's another...
Because Judge Hagel just read a whole bunch, and there's even more, which certainly indicate that you were responsible for full representation. Yes, the client could back out, but you were responsible for processing this thing through the board.
But only if the client wished to have that representation, Your Honor.
Well, that's true of any client. I mean, the client could fire you at any time. They could fire you the day after they hired you. So
well,
you can't bind the client.
Well, but it raises the question that Judge Hagel raised as to whether or not I have a continuing obligation under the Mason case that I have earned that contingent fee.
Well, before we get to Mason, you had a continuing obligation under this agreement to continue to represent the client through the board as long as the proceedings were going. You may have been able to stop after this court did not render a favorable decision. You didn't. You went to the Federal Circuit. You got a favorable decision, and you continued the representation.
Right. And then I entered into a separate fee agreement for representation back before the agency, and that's the contract that has been raised by the government. But that contract is expressly for representation, for the representation expressly following the successful representation before this court. Now, part of the problem here, Your Honor, is that we as attorneys don't have a horn book to go to say, this is how you write your fee agreements here. We're basically operating in the dark until we get the type of guidance under 7263 to find out what our fee agreements should say and what they shouldn't say. But what's before this court is the question of how the offset provisions of Title 28 under the Aegis statute operate in relationship to work performed before the Federal Circuit. Is that the same work? Or is the work for fees on fees under this court's decision in Cook, in fact, separate work? And should that be subject to a reduction in the offset obligation? And those are the two questions that Ms. Jackson presents to this
right.
court.
And but you are here as unequal parties. You're an attorney, trained, experienced. You wrote the contract, and your client did not. So when you read this particular client, this contract, it does not mention the Federal Circuit.
No, it does not.
But interpreting this is going to be interpreted against you. And let's just stick to the contract. At the end of the day, this representation doesn't mention the Federal Circuit, but you only get something if you ultimately get an award down below. So the processing ended up not being successful here. Went to the Federal Circuit, you continued representation, went down below, you continued before the board. Seems to me, interpreting this against you, if you will, you
That's
end
right.
up with your client's view of this being, hey, look, you know, you agreed to represent, and you didn't win it here. You went up to the Federal Circuit, you won. You ultimately won at the board. It's covered by the entire processing. Now, you can write the contract differently, and then we get into issues of true fairness, et cetera, but starting with a contract and reading it involving two unequal parties, you have to end up here with a client saying, hey, you agreed to represent me, you agreed to process this through the board.
But with all due respect, Your Honor, that is not the issue that's before the court. My client is not dissatisfied with her representation. Quite to the contrary, she is extremely satisfied with her representation. My client is asking this court, how do these specific fees get treated under Title 28? Are they or are they not the same
well,
work?
Help me with the question I was going to ask when I brought up the because I'm having a little trouble understanding if there is a contingent fee contract, as you've written with Mrs. Jackson.
What I intended.
She has attorney fees only when.
What I intended to write in this contract
right.
was that she would be only obligated to pay me a contingent fee if this court reversed and directed that there be an award on remand for compensation. Then and only as a result of representation before this court, then and only then would the contingent fee have kicked in. Now, I understand.
Okay. Let's just take it a hypothetical. Well, it's not hypothetical. We didn't reverse.
No, you did not.
The Federal Circuit did,
yes.
And then we reversed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So
but not with a direction to award.
That's okay. But we your contract says reverse or remand. For re-adjudication. You said what your intent was. But
right.
But it expressly it says that.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, EJA is for what?
For representation in the civil
it's to
proceeding.
Reimburse, is it to reimburse the litigant,
the
appellate?
That's correct.
For attorney fees.
For the cost of attorney fees and expenses.
Her cost of attorney fees is what?
Her total cost of attorney fees was what was awarded by this court, something in excess of $16,000. That award included three severable representations. One was the representation before this court on the attack against the board decision, the appeal that was taken under 7252 and 7266. Then there are two separate distinct representations before the Federal Circuit and before this court in defending the EJIA petition.
The representation before the Federal Circuit is based on what contract?
It's not based on a contract that's before this court. It's based upon the holding of this court in Hensley that work performed before the Federal Circuit was part of the non-exclusive jurisdiction of the Federal Circuit and could be considered as part of an EJIA application in this case.
But the appellant is the one who files an application for EJIA fees because
that's correct.
If they don't, they'll have to pay. They have to pay that to their attorney, right? They get reimbursed for the payment that they have to make.
In theory, that's correct, yes.
So was there fees owing you? Did she owe you fees for that representation?
No, in fact, the representation before the Federal Circuit was done pro bono and not done as part of a separate legal hourly rate or flat fee or any specific fee obligation on the part of Ms. Jackson.
Has that been represented here to the court before this moment?
No, it's not before the court.
There's no separate contract indicating that you were going to represent pro bono at the Federal Circuit?
No. I did that exclusively on my own, following the decision in this court.
I'd like to try to see if there's any unfairness here on one side or the other. To the attorney, looking at this thing critically. It seems to me that the attorney, our case law said that the attorney gets the greater of the two, EJIA or the contingent fee. If the attorney, in taking the risk of entering into a contingent free agreement, says, look, understands that, then if the contingent free agreement is, if the EJIA award, which the lawyer could bill here and at the Federal Circuit.
Well, I don't think and. In the alternative, I believe he could.
Well, if you're successful in the Federal Circuit, you can bill for your EJIA fees here, getting to the Federal Circuit.
I think he means filing the EJIA fee.
I'm not sure that's correct, Your Honor. I have not previously filed an EJIA application in the Federal Circuit, but understanding.
For work in the Federal Circuit, you file the EJIA fee application here.
Oh, yes, sir. I'm sorry.
But it encompasses work done both here
and
at the Federal Circuit.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
So if you've done sort of, because you had to go to the Federal Circuit, if you've done more work than you sort of initially contemplated when you made the contingent fee agreement, then your EJIA fees would be greater and you would be fully compensated for that, fully being a relative term. If, however, the amount of retroactive benefits was great enough, then you would receive from the direct fee agreement, payment, a sum greater than your EJIA award and therefore greater than what could be contemplated under that act. So I don't see any unfairness either way to the attorney here.
Well,
you're going to get the higher of the two, which means you're going to get fully reimbursed, at least fully in terms of the amount hourly rate permitted by EJIA. Fully reimbursed for the work you do here and at the Federal Circuit, and potentially, if the retroactive award is large, maybe even get more than EJIA, than an hourly, reasonable hourly rate under EJIA would pay you. So I don't see the unfairness here to holding that all aspects of the claim, as we did in Carpenter, would extend to both work at the Federal Circuit and work done to prepare the EJIA applications.
Well, I suppose that depends on whether or not this court reads Carpenter as overruling the holding in Fritz, which said that there is a separate question to be addressed as to the issue of same work. Now, Fritz was in the context of work on remand. This is not in the context of work on remand. And I think what the fairness question...
Now, why do you say it's not in the context of work on remand? Why do you say that?
Because the work performed before the Federal Circuit and the work performed in the defense of the EJIA application was not work performed in the effort to obtain the award of past due benefits on remand following the remand, the reversal and remand from this court in Ms. Jackson's appeal of the original board decision. It was part of the civil action, as was held in Fritz at the Federal Circuit, that the fees on fees issue is part of the civil action, and clearly the appeal to the Federal Circuit was part of the same civil action. So there's no question under a 5904 same case analysis that this is all part of the same case. The question that is presented here is that under Title 28, is it the same work? Is this identifiable, severable, separate work? If it is separate work, then it should not be subject to the offset provisions. And therefore, the total amount, the amount which has thus far been reimbursed to Ms. Jackson as the lesser amount, something in excess of $7,500, would be the total amount that she would be entitled to in reimbursement based upon EJIA if it's not the same work. If it is in fact the same work, but that's the issue that I believe needs to be addressed by this court, which is one of same work. And same work is not addressed by any decision of this court. It is not addressed in Carpenter, and it is not addressed in Fritz, except in the context of the potential that there may be differentiation between the work performed on remand. I believe that the same analysis applies here in reverse, that there is and can be a distinction. The question is that I believe you all must decide, and that is the case in controversy here, for both Ms. Jackson and myself, whether or not these two acts, representation before the Federal Circuit and representation in defense of an EJIA application, constitute the same work under Title 28. If they constitute the same work, then they're subject to reimbursement. If they do not constitute the same work, then they're not subject to reimbursement. And that is an issue that is beyond the existing case law.
Do you believe that the contract has any impact on whether or not it's the same work?
No. I understand that I made a declaration in the contract that at least as to fees on fees, it would not represent the same work, but I don't think that's any more binding on this court than I had said anything else in the fee agreement. To me, the contract itself does not implicate does not resolve the question. And the mere fact that I said so or Ms. Jackson and I might negotiate, as you earlier suggested, some resolution does not necessarily mean that that would be the correct resolution.
Well, as I understand it, we review it for whether or not the fee is excessive or unreasonable.
That's
Are you
correct.
Suggesting that the terms of the contract have no impact on whether or not a fee is excessive or unreasonable?
Well, as I understand this court's en banc decision in Carpenter, this court decided that the question of whether or not there would be reimbursement under EJIA does implicate those two alternative questions of reasonableness and excessiveness.
What about the terms of a contract? What if their contract specifically was, what if it was a clear contract and said, I will only represent you before the court and I get 30% of any fee award that comes about, even if I don't continue to represent you beyond the decision of the court? And you know, you have a contract similar to this, which is a little bit unclear as to how far you're going to represent them. does that have any impact? Does the terms of the agreement between the two parties have any impact?
It has an impact to the extent that...
Or do we review everything from a quantum merit type concept? In other words, we assess the amount of work and say, that's excessive for what you asked for or it's not. And we ignore the terms of a contract. I'm trying to figure out how this contract plays into it. Seems like you're asking us to ignore the terms of the contract.
Well, I'm not asking you to ignore the terms of the contract, Your Honor. I'm simply saying that the terms of the contract have no effect on the ultimate resolution of the two questions posed by Ms. Jackson and her attorney under 7263C. That does not mean, and I do not mean to suggest, that that somehow limits this court from reviewing the text of the fee agreement and coming to its own sua sponte independent determination as to how that may or may not affect the ultimate question of excessiveness or unreasonableness. I think, unfortunately, there is no clarity at this point as to what the difference would be between an unreasonable provision and an excessive award of fees. Mayhaps that is the distinction, that it is whether a particular provision renders a contract unreasonable under that standard and doesn't have anything to do with the total amount of fees. And excessiveness only deals with the total amount of fees. The fees in this case, ironically, between the percentage paid under the contingent fee contract for representation before the agency are almost identical to, I believe they're $15,000 and the EJIA total award is $16,000. So I don't think that there's any question about the two of those because I have already agreed that there is an offset obligation and I have given offset.
Doesn't that go back to the terms of the agreement? For example, if your agreement had specifically stated, I will represent you before the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and before the Federal Circuit and up through the Supreme Court, subject to my attorney's obligations to take a case, and if we have any success on remanding, I will continue to represent you down below, and ultimately, if there's an award, I will take 30%. If you had said that, would you be here today asking whether or not it's all offset?
Yes. Because I don't think it ultimately makes any difference to the questions that are being asked. The questions that are being asked is the representation before the Federal Circuit and the representation for fees on fees separate work under Title 28?
And separate work is not governed at all by the terms of the agreement?
It's not controlled by. There is a statement in the fee agreement that the work for fees on fees.
So you enter into a pro bono contract to take the case to the Federal Circuit and you sua sponte represent the appellant pro bono through the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court.
Yes.
I mean, does the appellant even know you're doing that?
Yes.
But the appellant's okay with that, I guess, because the appellant says, well, that... There's not going to be any cost to me.
That's correct.
Yet,
and she had already lost before this court.
If there's no cost to the appellant, this is where I'm getting into. If there's no cost to the appellant, then how is there an EJIA fee?
Well, under this court's case law, this court has concluded that that's eligible. But more importantly, Your Honor, that's water under the proverbial bridge in this case. This court has already reviewed the time spent and determined that those hours were compensable under EJIA. The only question...
I admittedly and probably did not look at the fee agreement.
But if you did, I think the point is that this court's case law is, whether you agree with it or not,
But you do have, since you're talking about offset, you're saying if you agree to take 30% of past due benefits as being your fee, right?
Yes.
As we look at it now, that has occurred.
Yes.
And if you got $1 million from that 30%, just hypothetically, and EJIA was $2 million, okay?
Okay.
Then what would happen?
Well, then I would retain the higher of the two, and she would not be obligated to pay the contingent fee.
But the $2 million was awarded to somebody, right?
It was awarded to her as reimbursement for my attorney fees.
which were only a million.
I'm sorry, I thought you said they were 2 million, but maybe no. I got your thing converted there. Excuse me, I got terribly confused.
I'm sorry, the 2 million was what came out of
your the award of past due benefit.
Your application for EJIA.
Oh, okay.
1 million is 30% of past due benefits.
That's right.
Which.
So she would get the lesser of the two, which would be the 1 million, and I would retain the 2 million in this rather bizarre hypothetical. I'm not used to EJIA fees.
In the Bahamas. I think the point is that's the court's case law, and you're still grappling. Even though you don't agree with it, no. Which I agree with you, no, but that's no, beside the point, I think.
No, because I guess the appellant is always saying, I've incurred costs to my attorney that I need to seek EJIA for. And those costs to me are my 30% that I have to give to the attorney.
Because
the attorney didn't charge me.
And in an absolute environment where there was no agreement to incur any attorney fees, then intuitively one would conclude that you wouldn't be eligible for EJIA. That just doesn't happen to be the law extant in this court.
Okay. Let's move to the
or in the United States as a whole.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
So you think there's no jurisdiction?
Good morning, Your Honor. The court has jurisdiction over the attorney fee agreements in this case. The court has discretion whether to review the attorney fee agreements in this case.
Both Kelly and Jackson?
My understanding is that the counsel has stepped away from the, okay. Check, right. The Kelly
you said,
case.
You said agreements.
I just want to get this straight. That is a different position than you took in your briefing, is it not? Didn't you argue that we did not have jurisdiction?
Our briefing indicated that in light of the Fritz decision, the court in Fritz chose not to exercise jurisdiction because it didn't have an active case of the appellant, of the veteran, before it. But the court took jurisdiction to decide that issue. That is, to take a look at the fee agreement, take a look at the status of the case, and decide and decline to review the fee agreement at that time, because there was no active appeal for the veteran. And that would, our position in Jackson, again, the court may first address the fact that Ms. Jackson had been granted the service connection for PTSD 16 months before the motion for the review of the fee agreement. It's the Secretary's position that there's no case or controversy at this point because the veteran's financial interests are protected under the en banc court's decision in Carpenter v. Principi, which confirmed that the attorney may retain the larger of the two funds, the attorney fee payments, or the agreed 30% of past due benefits, but not both. The court at that time, citing both legislative history and congressional intent, the Federal Circuit dismissed his appeal for lack of jurisdiction to review the Veterans Court decision on reasonableness of the attorney fee. The Carpenter decision also clearly determined and defined legal services provided to a veteran before the agency, the board, and the court at whatever tribunal as the same work. There are two potential streams of funds which may compensate the attorney who assists a claimant. One is under the EJIA, as been discussed with the court, and also from the past due benefits. The examples I was going to use would be much more modest, but in essence, if Mr. Carpenter had received $5,000 in EJIAs and then there was $100,000 in past due benefits, he could retain the $5,000 plus add $25,000 of the past due benefits for a total of $30,000. That would be his fee. However, in another case that had to go all the way to the Supreme Court, but only resulted in $10,000 in past due benefits, he could either have the $3,000, 30% of that $10,000, or he could keep retain the $75,000 that he earned in the time spent presenting the case to this court, the Federal Circuit, and to the Supreme Court. The Hensley case, as mentioned by counsel, this court indicated that he could file a NEJA application that would cover all levels of participation before the various tribunals. NEJA applications and payments are the claimant's funds to pay the attorney, but do not belong to the attorney. Since this court may review attorney fee agreements, one option that the court could have would be to refer this matter in Jackson to the agency so that a decision on eligibility or entitlement could be rendered by the regional office, and the board could issue a determination as to reasonableness. That way, there could be a development of the record. The arguments by both parties could be considered by the board. The court, upon review, would be doing a review de novo. However, it would have more of a record to consider before making a final determination. As also been previously raised, this court should not be in the position of giving an advisory opinion regarding how what the accounting methods were involved in this case, especially since it involved an extended period of time, some of which that information is not before the court.
What's the effect of counsel's and his client's agreement that this agreement would only be reviewed by the court and not the board?
You want to write,
it's on page 3, paragraph H, I think. The parties agree that the fee agreement is subject to review by the court only. It's not subject to review by the board, regardless of the fact that this agreement contemplates work to be performed before the agency. Could they agree to that?
No, Your Honor.
Or have it have effect, I guess.
I don't believe it should be given any effect by the court. Under the statute, either party could have a request that the agency review the the attorney fee agreement.
And the board could sua sponte do it on its own.
Yes, Your Honor. And looking above, also at paragraph E, in the fourth line, having the parties attempt to agree.
Are there any facts that need to be developed in this case? In other words, if we were to consider sending it back to the board, we could sua sponte review this. They could sua sponte review it. What facts would be developed down below, or that would?
Part of it may be, Your Honor, that the theory could be fleshed out. At this point, Ms. Jackson is entitled to $7,500 that is being retained by counsel.
That's your view.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
At one point, under the Carpenter case, the court sitting on bonk delineated a bright line test in terms of defining what is used in the calculation for the attorney fee agreement and past due benefits, and what is the relationship between the two. We have case law which has described that EJIA, there's only one EJIA per case. Until there's a payment made, it is a battle on behalf of the client, on behalf of the veteran, to win. And when there is a determination of the value of that EJIA, the time spent in defending it, should they have won at the lower level or continue to move forward, there's only one final amount that's awarded, and that's based on the amount of hours that is spent. So it never leaves the column of the veteran. It's always his or her money to pay to offset the attorney. And at the same time, you may have...
Under a normal case, you have... Let's say we take this case all the way through the Federal Circuit back to here and an application for EJIA and an EJIA award. And things are moving a little slowly down below. And there is no award at the time the EJIA application is approved up here. A year or two later, there is an award down below. The attorney up here got $10,000 in EJIA fees a year previous.
Yes, sir.
And now gets... $8,000, an award of $8,000 down below.
Yes, sir.
if the parties don't bring it an issue to the board, and the board doesn't sua sponte address it, the attorney keeps the $10,000, and the client keeps the $8,000, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, the parties could not come to this court at that time. Do you agree?
Not under Carpenter, Your Honor.
If the award by the agency had been $10,000 and the agreement, I mean $20,000, and the agreement between the parties indicated that it was 30%, it was not going to be paid directly by the agency, and you gave the money to the client, to the veteran, the counsel has an argument that he's entitled to the greater amount. At that time, that litigation would be brought where? In district court, or?
As in this case, Your Honor.
I guess they could bring it to the board.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know, and I don't know, do you know, could they also separately bring it in district court, or does the board have some kind of exclusive jurisdiction on that issue?
Well, I believe the matter would be returned to this court.
How would it get to this court?
Excuse me. Under the statute, it would be the responsibility of the agency, the secretary, to resolve this matter. Either party that was unhappy based on an attorney fee.
And then it can come back up through a board decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Under the facts and circumstances of this case, it's the secretary's position that the court should deny the request to review the fee agreement at this point. Secondarily, the court could refer the fee agreements to the agency for development and adjudication, or the court could decide to review the four corners of both the initial agreement in 2001 and the 2006 agreement, which took out some of the language that may have been in contravention of the Carpenter case, and decide at that point that there is no need to create any additional exceptions to the bright line rule. The exception that seemed to be proposed today would be something to the detriment of veterans, because it would reduce the amount of EJIA fees that they could use to offset what they have to pay to their attorneys. It would put veterans in a unfavorable or at a disadvantage, and that's not the purpose of the court's decision in Carpenter.
So let me just get this straight in my head. So we have counsel and his client who don't seem to have a dispute, both saying, let the court decide how these funds get paid. So in effect, you really have a dispute. The attorney's hanging on to the money and not giving it to the client.
Yes, sir.
That could be brought down below. The veteran could go to the secretary?
Yes, sir.
Right now. I mean, basically, are you saying, hey, they have a live issue here, but they just went to the wrong place?
Yes, sir.
Or maybe not the wrong place, but an alternate.
An alternate.
I think we have jurisdiction over the matter. Sua sponte, if we want to. And
yes,
I think
sir.
You could convert a motion into a sua sponte action. But what you're suggesting is that they can go below.
Yes, Your Honor.
If they want to. If they want to spend the time and effort to argue it down below and go through the whole process and proceedings and ultimately potentially an appeal to the court, et cetera, they could do that. Or they might come to some agreement and we don't have to address it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Got it.
Part of the problem also is that within the four corners of the fee agreements that counsel has brought to this court, there is no discussion of fees for fees. There is no discussion of representation before the Federal Circuit.
There's also some other agreement that may have been made, and the possibility of a pro bono representation agreement that may have been made, and all these other factors.
Yes, Your Honor. However, as the judge pointed out, it's all pro bono. When you lost before the Veterans Court and you went to the Federal Circuit, it's still pro bono. There's no money that's owed by the veteran. He or she is only going to pay out of past due benefits if she
or it might be a contingent. I mean, there is a difference between true pro bono, at
yes,
least
sir.
I think there is, and a contingent that comes to life when ultimately an award is made.
Yes, sir.
And one, I think this, I don't want to speak with Chief Judge, but it may have been bothering, pro bono we kind of got in our head, but if we have a contingent contract, does that somehow overtake the situation?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that how does that play on it?
Any further questions, John? Thank you. I'd like to begin by clarifying what I believe is a mischaracterization by the VA that Ms. Jackson was capable of taking this matter to the board. The board's jurisdiction to sua sponte review or hear on a motion expired when Congress amended 5904. What the date of the action here is May of 2000 that made the award of past due benefits. So the fact is that this falls into that no man's land between the direction from Congress to the VA to promulgate regulations and the fact that they promulgated those regulations, and then those regulations were not expressly made retroactive. So as a consequence, when this occurred, there was no right to file a motion at the board. There was no existing regulation that specified how you would ask for review by the VA, although the statute was amended that it would now be the VA as opposed to the board that would do the review. The regulation as adopted puts a specific time limit, I believe of 120 days, from the time in which the decision was made that triggered the fee agreement to ask for review. Obviously, that regulation was not in effect in May of 2007, and therefore there is no, as has been suggested by the government, any alternative remedy to Ms. Jackson or to myself to either individually or jointly ask.
If your client disagreed with your view of the contract, could she go to a state or district court?
I believe she could go. I'm not sure that either state or district court would accept it based upon the exclusive jurisdiction of this court to review decisions by the VA, and that this would be a decision by the VA.
Well, you've just given us a situation where VA can't give you a decision.
That's correct.
So it's a void.
And
but a contract dispute if
there were a contract dispute. But I will tell you in all candor, Your Honor, if my client had said, I believe I am entitled to those monies, I'd have given them to her.
But doesn't that mean you've got an advisory, you're asking for an advisory opinion?
But that's what 7263C provides for, Your Honor.
Only if it rises to unreasonable and...
Are you asking us, is your situation excessive?
I'm asking whether or not the result of not offsetting for the representation at the Federal Circuit and the defense of fees on fees results in an excessive award under that fee agreement, because there is a requirement to offset. What is not clear by the case law is what the amount of that offset is. Is it $7,500 or is it
$16,000? Do you understand the Secretary's argument to be that it would be excessive, that their view is that it is excessive? I mean, they may not have a role in this, given what you just told us. But they seem to indicate that it's settled law and you shouldn't be taking that money.
Yes, they believe that there is a bright line created in Carpenter. I disagree that there is a bright line created in Carpenter. Carpenter is entirely contingent upon the specific facts in Carpenter of the review of a board decision that found that an EJA offset was required. They found that an EJA offset was required based upon the fee agreement in that case. The question before this court is not whether an EJA offset is required, but how much of an EJA offset is required. And that is a different question, and that is not a question that has been addressed by the case law up to this point. And I believe that that therefore implicates the provisions of 7263 and permits both the appellant and the attorney to ask this court for an advisory opinion. Unless there's any further questions. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Case is submitted. We will greet counsel at the bar, and the court will be adjourned.